All right, folks, good morning. How are you? I'll take that as everybody's good. Thank you. All right, our first matter is Mr. Ewing's matter. On behalf of the state, Ms. Luzich, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Justice, I'd ask to reserve 3 minutes.
Okay. Go ahead and start. Thank you.
Good morning, Justices. My name is Lisa Luzich. I represent the appellant, the state of Nevada. I was not only the trial attorney in this case, I had this case from the very beginning. I am the one who took it to the grand jury. In this case, the lower court's decision to bar retrial was clearly erroneous and was not based upon substantial evidence. That court found that the state had knowing it had no contact with the alleged victim since prior to the beginning of jury selection, chose to have the sexual assault nurse examiner testify in direct contradiction of this court's ruling in Medina. And that is not what happened at all. We had been in contact with Emma, the victim in this case. Emma spoke with my investigator. I wouldn't say regularly, but often for the 3 years from 2019 when we went to the grand jury until 2023. Okay, I don't know how to add, that's 4 years, sorry. When we went to trial, there were occasions that we would kind of lose contact with Emma, but she would contact us again and we would always be back in contact with her. She came here voluntarily for the grand jury. We actually went to grand jury because we just couldn't get the prelim on. I rarely take sex cases to the grand jury, but Emma was cooperative all along. She was afraid of the defendant. And in fact, one of the trial dates had gotten continued because Emma had been threatened by the defendant's friends and had to leave her home, her job, and moved to another city in California on the spur of the moment and could not come here. I think that the court misunderstood. Emma never lived here. Emma lived in California when these events occurred. She went back to California. She came here from California to testify at the grand jury. And around the timing of the August 2022 trial, she was visiting in Texas, found a job, and had decided to move to Texas. So when we were in contact with Emma in end of July, early August, Emma was having us make arrangements to bring her from Texas to Las Vegas and then fly her back to California. So she was that involved in the process of preparing for trial.
Counsel, can I just ask you a quick question? By the time that trial started, so I believe the jury began to hear testimony on Friday, August 26th.
Yes.
Had the victim's appearance been secured? Were travel arrangements made? My understanding is that she had not actually been secured by the first day of trial. And then when your investigator was asked, well, did you try to contact her over the weekend? She said something to the effect, I don't work on weekends. So I'm just wondering at what point, if at all, did you actually confirm and secure the witness's appearance?
I guess I am not entirely sure what you mean by secured the witness's appearance.
Just ensure that she was going to come testify before you started putting witnesses on.
Well, my investigator spoke with her the week before trial on the 15th of August, and she said, yes, I'm coming. She spoke with her again on Monday, the 22nd, and Emma said, yes, I'm coming. In fact, please talk to my employer so that we can make arrangements that will limit her days off from work. It was a new job, and she didn't want to take off any more time than she absolutely had to. So we had spoken to Emma about fly Sunday, testify Monday, fly back Tuesday. And then on the 23rd, so Monday was the 21st. We did not start trial on Monday. I had been out of town and the judge had been out of town. So we got a Tuesday start. It took several days to pick the jury. While I was picking a jury on the 23rd, which was Wednesday, my investigator spoke with Emma's employer, and the conversation was, yes, Emma's going to come. She told me, Emma told employer, that she was going to come and that Emma wanted the employer to talk with us so that, A, the employer knew that she really did have to come, and B, when it would benefit the employer the most to have her travel here. So on the 23rd, she spoke, my investigator, Kristen Carnell, spoke with the employer on the 23rd, Wednesday, and then on the 20, I guess that was Tuesday, And then on the 25th, Thursday, while I was still picking a jury, the employer called back and said, instead of having her fly Sunday, testify Monday, fly back Tuesday, can you please have her fly Monday, the 29th, testify Tuesday, and if possible, fly back Tuesday night. So we said, absolutely. And at that point, Kristen, my investigator, was calling and texting Emma to confirm, yes, those are the days you want to come, and I need a copy of your license to make your flight arrangements. When we fly people in from another jurisdiction, we don't generally make flight arrangements a week in advance. It's once the trial is absolutely going and we decide when we want them to come. Arrangements are often made a day or so early. It's crazy, it's expensive, but if you make it in advance, they're not refundable. So very often they are arrangements are actually made a day or so in advance. So it was on the 25th when Kristen, my investigator, was trying to contact Emma, and Emma did not respond. But we did not think that there was a problem on the 25th because it often took Emma days to respond. You know, she rarely, if ever, responded within the same, like, 24-hour period. If we called her in the morning, she wouldn't call back until either a day or 2 days later. So on the 25th, we didn't think there was anything wrong. By the night of the 25th, when Kristen had been calling repeatedly and texting and emailing, I was worried, and I actually told Mr. Coca, trial counsel for the defense, that we're trying to get a hold of her today. She's not returning our calls today. I just want to let you know, but I'm still putting Jerry on tomorrow morning because I think that we will get a hold of her, and she's not supposed to fly until Monday. I have plenty of time to get her here. So on Friday morning, when I put Jerry Dermanellian on the stand, or Friday, whatever time of day it was, I was still fully expecting Emma to travel here on Monday so that she could testify on Tuesday.
But nobody tried to get a hold of her over the weekend, is that?
Well, I did. I wasn't able to. My investigator did not.
Okay. And did anyone issue a subpoena? And as if the record was unclear.
Yes, we issued a subpoena. My investigator emailed it to her and texted it to her. But under our statutes, a promise to appear, an oral promise to appear, is the equivalent of personal service. So she was personally served. She acknowledged that she had received the subpoena both by email and by text. And she gave us an oral promise to appear. So as far as I'm concerned, that is securing the witness. I just didn't know, did you mean secure as in get her here? Obviously, she never got on a plane. And when, you know, the question of Kristen was asked at the evidentiary hearing, did you make travel arrangements? It's, well, she can't make travel arrangements until we get the picture of her driver's license so that the information can be provided to the airlines. That's all that, you know, post 9/11 thing. I had every reason to believe when I had Jerry Dermanellian testify that Friday that Emma was going to come. On Monday, well, over the weekend, I was not able to reach her either, but on Monday, when we had no contact with Emma, we still continued to try, hopefully get her on a plane that day. By the end of the day, when she wasn't in contact with us again, neither was her employer. The employer stopped responding to Kristen as well. So at that point, I had to make the decision to just proceed without her. The difference is that when the judge made her determination, she kind of conflated the difference between lost contact with and haven't spoken to. So we hadn't technically totally lost contact with Emma, I would suggest, until late on Friday, when there was nothing else that we could do. We were still trying to reach out. The court put an extra layer of prosecutorial, I guess, she called me unethical. She said that I committed misconduct by knowingly putting Jerry Dermanelian on the stand and asking her those questions, knowing that I was not going to have Emma, and that is not correct at all. Under either of the Hilton or the Lacey tests, it was a mistrial granted because of improper conduct by me, the prosecutor. Was the conduct that I intentional conduct that I knew to be improper and prejudicial? And it was not under Lacey and under Hilton. The mistrial was declared by reason of manifest necessity. And that's why when we had the evidentiary hearing that day with Kristen, I specifically asked her, Judge, you are declaring a mistrial, yes, and you are declaring the mistrial based on manifest necessity. And she said, I recognize that those words were not in her findings of fact, conclusions of law and order, but that was what she ruled on the day that she had the hearing, that it was based upon manifest necessity.
Just trying to pin down the timeline. How soon before the first day of trial, when was the last time anyone had contact with the witness prior to trial starting?
My investigator actually spoke to her on Monday the 22nd before the trial started, and she told us to have contact with her employer, which we did. And the employer was indicating to us that she had been in contact with Emma and Emma was still coming. So on the 23rd and the 25th, according to the employer, Emma was still coming.
And then 26th was the first day of trial?
It was the first day of witnesses, yes. And that's when Jerry Dermanelian testified. I see that I have 2.5 minutes.
Of course. We'll give you an extra minute and we'll give Mr. Owens an extra minute as well. But I know Mr. Owens in his reply brief brought up briefly the issue of consent to mistrial. You all brought it up in your reply brief. And I'm just curious as to how this played out at the hearing. The court seems to have focused on Thomas as being the appropriate analysis as opposed to Hilton, somehow finding that the defense asked for a mistrial, which you all both seem to concede that's not the appropriate analysis because the defense didn't ask for a mistrial. But it appears that because of that, maybe the court never addressed whether there was consent to a mistrial. So I'm just curious if there's anything you all can fill in on the record.
Well, I do agree that the defense did not request the mistrial. However, I suggest to the court that the defense did consent to it because when on the day of the hearing, when she said that she was granting a mistrial, Mr. Coca's response was, Your Honor, no, I think absent dismissal, I think that this is just the thing to do at this point. So he is telling her, yes, dismissal is appropriate. So I suggest that there was defense consent to the mistrial. They didn't request it, but they consented to it.
But it didn't appear from the court's order that the court ever addressed the issue at the time of the hearing on whether the mistrial was going to be with or without prejudice. And that's why I'm just saying, am I missing anything? Because I don't see it anywhere in the written order that the court brought it up, but it seems like the court was focused on the wrong analysis.
I agree. I think that pretty much all of what the court did in response to this issue was incorrect.
Well, was that issue raised below?
Mr. Robbins may disagree.
was the implied consent raised below? I think it was raised before us the first time in the reply brief. Was it raised below before the district court?
No, we did not discuss implied consent in the district court at the hearing.
All right, thank you.
So if I might reserve my time.
Yes. Please.
Thank you.
All right. And we'll, as I said, we'll add a minute to Mr. Rowan's time as well. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Steve Owens on behalf of the respondent, Calvin Ewing. Unlike Ms. Luzich, I was not trial counsel. That was Frank Koch. I've been appointed for purposes of the appeal. And so unlike Ms. Luzich, my understanding factually of what happened below is limited to what I can read in the record. And we heard from Ms. Luzich here today a lot of facts that I did not see anywhere in the record. Ms. Luzich did not testify at the evidentiary hearing. The state's investigator did. But there was quite a few facts there that are not in the record, were not before the district court judge, and this court does not sit as a fact finder. So all this, the facts about the victim had been threatened by the defendant's friends, which is why she had to move, that she went to Texas and found a job, that they were in contact July and August, that she didn't want to take time off because it was a new job. None of that's in the record. This business about when flights are booked and the reasons why, that's not in the record. What the employer had said wasn't in the record. And that Ms. Luzich tried to contact the victim over the weekend. That's not in the record. The record is silent. What the district court judge below was faced with was testimony from the investigator that the last contact with the victim was on August 22nd before the trial even started. And here we got 1, 2, 3 days of voir dire, and then it looks like 3 days of testimony with an intervening weekend and no further contact from the victim. When the state puts on the second day of trial, not the last witness, but the second day of trial, they put on the same nurse. I think in their brief, the state's trying to present this case as just a run-of-the-mill situation where a witness doesn't show up for trial, and it's a surprise, unexpected, and so what do we do? And they say to the Connery case, and I'm glad they did because there are so many differences between what happened in Connery and what happened here. In Connery, when the state's critical key witness didn't show up, the prosecutor asked for a continuance. That didn't happen here. The prosecutor, when that failed, the prosecutor moved for a mistrial and took on and shouldered that that test of manifest necessity and overcame it. So there won't be any chilling effect by denying retrial here in this situation, because all those cases where truly a victim failed to show up, who's been subpoenaed, fails to come to court through no fault of the prosecutor, there's authority, case authority, the law provides for that, it's manifest necessity, no bar to retrial. What the prosecutor did in this case was rested their case, sat down and rested the case. And what we also have here is this this confrontation violation that occurred that didn't occur in Connery. Knowing that there's this glaring confrontation error in the case, the state did nothing. And that's what put Mr. Koch in this very uncomfortable position and the judge in this position of what do we do now? How do we go forward? How do we remedy this? And so they take issue with me saying there wasn't manifest necessity. Well, that wasn't the analysis, but just on the record that we have, there was no manifest necessity because they didn't do a continuance, didn't ask for a continuance. The witness in Connery had attempted suicide in the middle of trial. So we can understand that's not the state's responsibility here. It's simply that the victim is lackadaisical and goes out of contact with the state on occasion. And that's something that they knew. They knew there's a history of it. This is not a witness who has been punctual in the past and had no problems with. They have gone out of contact with her. And furthermore, she's a victim who lives out of state. The state doesn't have power to compel, which is they don't like that the judge brought up this domestication of the subpoena. But when you have an out-of-state witness, you have to contemplate as a prosecutor that, well, what do I do if this goes south and they don't show up? Can I compel them? I didn't hear anything from the prosecutor in this case about let's get a continuance. Let's find out why the victim failed to show up. Was there a car accident? Is she in the hospital? Is she truly unavailable? Can I remedy the confrontation violation that's now in the record? Can I still get the victim here? Can I declare her unavailable and still comply with the confrontation right? I didn't see any of that happen.
How, if at all, does the fact that Mr. Coca didn't object to Mr. Anelian's testimony affect things? Because that's the only one that the court said was testimonial in nature, not the 911 call or the security officer.
Right.
And I understand after the fact, Mr. Coca said, well, I was expecting the victim to come and I would have been able to cross-examine her. But it doesn't appear that he objected on any basis to Dermanellian's testimony coming in at the time it was offered.
Well, look at the position that Mr. Coca was in, and he made a good record about this after the fact as to why he didn't object, and I didn't hear anything from the prosecutor denying that anything that he said was true. The two attorneys were talking off the record about the order of witnesses and about the victim coming in, and repeatedly the state assured the defense attorney that I've got the victim, she's coming in. So he's trying the case as if I've got a victim who's going to come in at the end, and I need to be able to impeach her. And so we do this all the time in every trial. Sometimes the attorneys will play with the order of witnesses to avoid having to recall them. Ms. Luzage made the decision of when to put the same nurse on the stand and whether to go into those testimonial statements or not. And so Mr. Cope has got, you know, he's been assured that the victim's going to show up. I don't think that was the time to object. He wanted strategically all those inconsistent statements to come in so that he could impeach the victim. That was his theory of defense, which again is why this is so egregious. The confrontation violation totally destroyed his theory of defense. How does the prosecutor sit down and rest their case knowing they've just decimated the defense theory by slipping in something to the defense's disadvantage? Unlike Connery, where they moved for a mistrial, Ms. Luzage didn't want to move for a mistrial because she had gotten in what she needed to prove her case. Ordinarily, if it's the state's key witness, they're going to lose. They can't go forward. They can't rest. They can't let it get submitted to the jury. They're going to get dismissed. And so it's incumbent on them to move for the mistrial. She didn't do it because she'd already gotten in illegally the testimonial hearsay that she needed from the nurse. She got in that statement about strangulation. The jury heard that, and they would not have, there was no other way to get that in. And so she shifts that to Mr. Coca. And I don't think saying that Mr. Coca should have objected sooner in the record, somewhere along the way, that undermines the analysis of the court's look at was the defense goaded or provoked into the mistrial or dismissal or was the defense put in this untenable position? And that's what happened here. We got a defense attorney that did nothing wrong and yet was put in this untenable position of choosing to go forward with a trial that is got this fatal constitutional defect in that the state's not taking responsible for. Or do I now have to go on the record seeking some sort of relief?
And wouldn't that constitute manifest necessity because of the constitutional violation of the Confrontation Clause?
I think you have to look at why there was the constitutional error and what efforts were made to cure it. From Mr. Coca's point of view or the judge's perspective, there's nothing they can do. An instruction, you can't just move to strike and ask the jury not to consider it. But from the prosecutor's point of view, which is what you're looking at for manifest necessity, I think you also have to look at what else could the state have done? Was this inevitably a lost cause or could it have been salvaged? And the things, like I said, asking for continuance, getting on the phone, finding out why the victim's not there. California's 4 hours away. Send an investigator. Call up a local law enforcement officer. Go do a welfare check on her. They know her employer. Get some more information. Report back to the court the next day. Here's the situation. She attempted suicide. She was in a horrible car accident. Or she just didn't want to come. And now, Judge, I would like to compel her. I asked for an extension of time to go through that process.
Well, all of that was open to the court, right? I mean, the court could have done any of those things. Whether anybody made motion or not, the court's the one that raised mistrial. The only motion before the court was to dismiss. So the court could have said, well, what about if we continue it a couple of days? What if they do a motion to compel? I'll send the jury home for a couple of days. I mean, I don't know that the analysis is any different about what the court did in determining the mistrial was going to be with prejudice if the state had said prior to arresting, we thought the victim was going to be here and now she's not here, so we're just going to rest on the evidence we have, or we can ask to continue it a couple of days, or you can grant a mistrial, whatever. I don't know that analysis changes on that, does it?
Well, I don't think the judge has a burden to go compel a witness to come to court. It's the state gets to choose how.
No, I don't mean that. I mean, if the judge is the one that inserted mistrial into it.
Yes.
And I don't have any issue with that, right? But the judge could have inserted any of those things into it. Let's continue it a couple of days. Can you see if you can get contact? Why don't you do a motion to compel? Or, you know, I can grant a mistrial or whatever it may be. I just don't know that that analysis is any different based on the state saying we're just going to rest, or if the state had said we tried to get our victim here, she's not here, so we're prepared to rest, but I don't know what Mr. Coca may want to do. The analysis of whether it should have been with prejudice or not, I don't think changes because of that.
Well, perhaps not, and that's why if the state or the court sua sponte, they're both represent the state against the defendant, so the analysis is the same in terms of that. And you just said something there. The judge could have asked Mr. Coca, how do you feel about the mistrial? In the implied consent cases that I saw, that's the key thing. That's what the judge could have done. Instead of trying to read tea leaves here, right, was there some sort of implied consent? Put him on the spot. State, Mr. Coca, I'm not granting the motion to dismiss. How do you feel about a mistrial? And then if he's silent, then you might imply consent. But he can speak up and say, yeah, I agree with it, or no, I don't.
Well, but if we ask him, we're trying to get express. Right? It's not implied consent. It's more express. But I agree with you. I mean, that was always my practice, because a lot of times defense counsel may say, we don't want a mistrial. We like our jury. We think the state's case is weaker by not having a victim here. So we want to keep going forward. You never know. But
and that's why I brought up in my answering brief this implied consent, because it was the state that interjected. The wrong standard was used. It should have been manifest necessity. But then it never moved for mistrial. And I'm like, well, technically they're right. He didn't. He moved to dismiss. I think the judge treated that as a motion for mistrial, but he moved to dismiss. And so, yeah, I said he didn't impliedly consent to anything. And so that's how that issue got introduced. It was not addressed below. It's raised really or argued. I was agreeing with the state's opening brief as to, hey, if they want to use the manifest necessity test, I'm not going to say no to that.
Right.
I think that's better for my client. Let's apply that one. And I think I went even easier. But they're trying to now argue implied consent in the reply brief. I think that is improper, and we don't have facts in the record to support that anyway. Well, I think I touched on all the points that I have of interest. Unless there's questions from the court, I think it would be improper. I know it feels like a windfall, but no one likes to see a trial end this way. Justice is better served when we can get the case to the jury. But for the double jeopardy clause to have any meaning, the defendant had his day in court. He faced the trial. The state had their one chance, their bite at the apple. And I think there were some mistakes. I wouldn't call it unethical, but I think there were some mistakes that the state made. I think they could have done it differently how they did in Connery, and or been more careful in their questioning of the same nurse, knowing that they had a victim that was maybe in the wind. They could have protected against the risk. That's really what we're talking about. Not that they intentionally provoked the mistrial, but they pursued a course that was recklessly indifferent to the real possibility of a mistrial and the actual prejudice that would now be heaped on Mr. Coca. And I think that's precisely what the double jeopardy clause is there to protect against, so that they shouldn't be allowed to correct the mistakes in the new trial and get things right that they didn't get right the first time and prosecute Mr. Ewing again. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
All right. Ms. Lusage?
I didn't ask for a continuance because I did not have a good faith belief that I would be able to get Emma within a short period of time. And I think that would have been disingenuous. Emma was not in California. She was in Texas. So it's not quite as easy to send an investigator to go looking for her throughout the state of Texas. But as far as the strangulation, the strangulation could have been proven very easily without her statements, because there was physical corroborative evidence. She was beat. She had the CTA, the and the of the neck showed bruising in there, and she had demonstrated, like Jerry actually handed her one of those little, you know, heads and said, show me what he did. So that is not a hearsay statement. That's just an action. So she demonstrated for Jerry, and Jerry demonstrated for the jury what the strangulation entailed.
Counsel, would you agree with counsel that there are a lot of facts that are being introduced for the first time on appeal that were not in the record below?
Well, actually, the judge was aware of all those facts because 2 weeks before the trial, they had made a motion to release the defendant, and all of those facts came out in that motion. And the judge actually commented on it when Mr. Coca said that he was going to be asking for a release, and she said we had just talked about it 2 weeks earlier. I see my time is up, so unless the court has any questions.
Was that motion part of the record that was submitted to us? The motion that you just referenced?
I don't know if the actual transcript of the motion was in the record, but in the record on the day that she declared the mistrial, that conversation is in there about how we had just talked about his release and why he hadn't been released. So I would ask the court to find that the declaration with prejudice was an error and overturn that. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Appreciate the briefing and the argument today. The matter will stand.